This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. New polling shows high marks for Governor Mike DeWine's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic in Ohio. 86% of adults say they approve, but his fellow Republican governors are not always as universally lauded. Let's talk about this data. Scott Clement is the polling director at the Washington Post. He joins us now on the phone. Scott, thank you so much for being with us today.
Certainly. Glad to be on.
Well, we're glad to have you. And it must be interesting being a director of polling at a national publication like the Washington Post, where I'm sure you're used to finding a lot of partisanship and a lot of division within the American populace. But we're seeing some bipartisan approval of governors across the country. And I guess I'd just like to start with what your take is on that.
Sure. So definitely is a brave new world in people's reactions to the coronavirus outbreak. One thing that's been pretty consistent in our polling over the last month is that people have had much greater trust in their local leaders than their national leaders and leaders of political parties who they have, you know, deeply worn partisan views of, and that governors in particular have seen pretty high approval ratings and a substantial amount of approval from people outside the political party, which is fairly unusual, but does happen sometimes in moments of crisis where leaders are put on a much greater stage and people are worried. Those two things seem to have combined.
And typically that can benefit a president as well. According to this polling, though, and other polling examples, that's not reflected in President Trump's approval and his response to this, correct?
That's right. Our own post-ABC national polling did find a bump in Trump's approval in late March, really as the outbreak was spreading aggressively in New York and in other states. But that's been fairly short-lived, according to other polling, some of which we've conducted. In this latest very large national poll we did, 43% approved of the way Trump has handled the outbreak, which is, if you look back, very similar to the kinds of approval ratings he's had throughout his presidency, pretty standard. We also found that in states, partisans just have very predictable views of the way Trump is handling things. And so he hasn't gotten the benefit of the doubt from Democrats and in support from Democrats for how he's handling it, but he can still bank on strong support from Republicans. And that's what's really kept his ratings where they are.
Yeah, that's what's unique about this particular batch of polling that was released in this article this week at the Washington Post, is that when you look at someone like Governor Mike DeWine, who is a Republican in a large state like Ohio, he's got high numbers as it relates to approval because of support from both parties. And so we started this conversation by talking about bipartisan approval. With President Trump and some other governors, we are still seeing some partisan polarization, right?
Yes, and I think the degree of partisan polarization in a fascinating way varies depending on the state that you're in. And we ask people, do you approve of the way your state's governor is handling the coronavirus outbreak? And in Ohio, for instance, Mike DeWine gets 90% approval rating among Democrats, which is just remarkable. It really is hard to not to imagine that, but it's just that's very unusual for a governor. At the same time, we see some Republican governors getting ratings well below 50% among Democrats. That's not surprising at all. They're from opposite political parties, rival political parties. And then others who are sort of in the middle. The average is between 54 and 55% for governors' approval ratings among the opposite party, which I think is still fairly high. I think that's a lot of trust from people who disagree on a lot of major political issues.
And we're talking with Scott Clement. He is the director of polling at the Washington Post. And according to the polling that the Washington Post reported this week, here in Ohio, 86% of adults overall say they approve of the way Governor Mike DeWine has handled the pandemic here. And then you compare that in the next sentence to Georgia, where 39% of adults approve of the performance of Governor Brian Kemp, who is a fellow Republican, but he was known to have moved less quickly than some of the other governors in some of the efforts to mitigate the spread of the virus. But he's also been a very early champion of reopening the economy there. So how are those decisions reflected in this polling, as you can ascertain?
Well, one thing we saw, both in Georgia, but also in Texas and Florida, where roughly 6 in 10 approve of the governors in those states, and that's relatively low. The average for all governors was 71%. So, you know, being 10 points below isn't that bad. Georgia's 39% really sticks out as quite low. One unifying factor for those three places is that residents were far more likely to say that their state was lifting restrictions too quickly. 28% nationally said their state is lifting restrictions too quickly. Most, 56%, say that they're doing it about right. But in Florida, 48%, nearly half, said that their state has lifted restrictions too quickly. That rises to 59% in Texas and 65% in Georgia. That's probably not the only reason that governors are facing lower approval ratings in those states, but it is one unifying factor, and it really differs from other states, which are fairly consistent on this. I think Ohio actually represents a really interesting place because Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine might have gotten some credibility early for closing early, which is interesting, and you can see that sort of in the bipartisan trust. So he has seemed to navigate this difficult territory relatively well compared to his fellow governors.
And over the past several weeks, Scott, we've seen certainly some widespread coverage across the country of protests erupting maybe at the state capitals or in other parts of a community about, you know, demanding that the economy start to reopen. But the next day after this governor polling, the Washington Post published a poll about Americans' expectations for when they expect larger public gatherings to resume. And it looks like most agree now that it would be July at the earliest before this starts. So are we seeing some reflection of Americans' expectations of when they feel it will be safe to go outside and how the governors are responding to what some call a crisis?
Now, so what we're seeing in that particular question, you said it exactly right, that, you know, we asked just people what they think. When do you think it'll be safe for people to gather in groups of 10 or more? And I was struck a month ago, even less than a month ago, 45% said that it would take until at least July. Now that's up to 66% who have said that. If you look at the numbers overall, it looks like people have shifted back their expectations by about a month. And maybe they were overly optimistic early, though. People were not saying in April that they thought it would be safe very soon. So I think it's people have definitely taken a step back. Even though we're closer to opening a lot of states, and many states have opened up partially, people's personal feelings of safety don't seem to have changed a great deal. And it's starting to set in how long it may take for things to get back to normal.
And there are some signs of the local economy starting to reopen in different parts of the world, certainly here in Ohio. I know that some folks are excited to finally be able to get back to a restaurant and sit on a patio very soon or get a haircut. But it appears, according to the polling, that large majorities of respondents suggest that they believe that they should keep up with some of the social distancing and some of the other mitigations like wearing a mask. Your report shows 86% say it's still necessary to stay 6 feet apart from people in public. 80% say they will wear a mask when coming close to people. 78% say they want to stay at home as much as possible. So it looks like polling's not reflecting that, but just a small minority of the population is eager to be out in non-essential ways.
Yeah, I was struck by the size of majorities on these questions about, and these are standard things that people have been told to do by their local governments and federal governments and health agencies over the last couple months. And, you know, we're a couple months into the real height of the outbreak. Where are people? And people tend to think that they're necessary right now. There are some partisan differences on those, but clear majorities across party lines say that masks are necessary, that people should be staying 6 feet away from each other. So it tells me that these recommendations have set in as best practices. Now, whether that means that 80% of people are going to be wearing masks all the time in public. I'm skeptical of that, but the norms have been set. And I think that the leadership at different levels of government and different levels of health agencies all sort of voicing very similar messages probably played a role in that. We'll see where people are in a few months as they're able to see what, you know, how things go as different places open, whether they're able to maintain case counts at a low rate.
And we're talking with Scott Clement, the director of polling at The Washington Post. I thought it was also interesting that your polling, Scott, found that 55% of Americans currently say they think people in their communities are striking the right balance on practicing social distancing, while 33% say people are not taking those practices seriously enough. So you've got polling that shows overwhelming majorities are aware of what they believe they need to do to stay safe during this period. And they also know what other people need to be doing as well, and they're keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a spy on your neighbor question, right? You know, how well do you think people are doing? I mean, there are opinions on you know, the coronavirus outbreak everywhere, and so we just want to know what people think. How do they think they're doing? And most think they're doing okay. Most people think that they're doing the right thing. There are a pocket about one in three that say people should be doing more. And that peaks among Democrats. It also peaks among people who are most worried about getting infected themselves. It's one thing we've seen through all of our polling is that personal worry factors in, if at least as much, if not more, than partisanship. And that is true for Democrats and Republicans. So I think that's something really important to watch is how much people's fears persist over the coming months and how that shapes, you know, their behavior.
One interesting and important note that some of your polling has found is also reflected in another article at The Washington Post this week, especially relevant as more parts of the economy start to reopen and more people resume traditional workplace activity. And you found that a majority of Americans are concerned about going to work and then exposing their household to the virus. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So this was a survey specifically focused on people who have been leaving home to go to work at least once a week. And we interviewed more than 2,000 of these workers and found 58% of them said they're very or somewhat concerned about exposing a family member. This also peaks among several groups. One of the bigger divides is partisan. Democrats are more concerned than Republicans. But women are also more concerned, as well as Hispanic and African American workers, than whites. So this is a question we're probably going to need to keep asking as more and more people go to work. But the perspective of our story was really, what do the people who have been going to work have to say to those who may be starting to go to work? What stories can they tell? And this concern is one important part of it.
Yeah, I mean, because the message has been stay safe at home. And if three out of four people in the household are staying home, but one is going out and coming back in, then I guess how safe can you be? And it is interesting to point out the demographics that you measured here, as you just noted, but I want to give the exact numbers. Overall, 58% of U.S. adults, according to your polling, concerned about going to work and possibly exposing the household to the coronavirus. But 72% of Hispanic Americans, 68% of Black Americans, and only 50% of White Americans are either very or somewhat concerned about exposing the household. Beyond the basic polling and the demographics, was there any exploration as to why that disparity exists between White Americans and their Black and Hispanic neighbors?
You know, we didn't dive deep on this particular poll. We talked to some folks who, some respondents who were African American and Hispanic about that, and they cited, you know, concerns that I think are fairly understandable. But the overall trends have been, for one, Hispanics have consistently expressed greater concern about being infected, regardless of whether they're going to work. And then, of course, African Americans have seen higher rates of death from the outbreak. And they're also more likely to know somebody who's gotten seriously ill from it. So part of this is personal experience. Part of it may also be, the ability to deal with becoming infected, and sort of economic and educational differences of those racial and ethnic groups. So I think what we're seeing is a little bit of experience and also just a little bit of how these different groups have absorbed information about the outbreak.
Well, this polling and reporting at the Washington Post has been fascinating to read this week. I'm sure it will continue to be fascinating as we and our fellow Americans continue to navigate this pandemic and see how we all start to feel about it a month or so out. I want to thank Scott Clement, the polling director at the Washington Post. It was great talking to you. I hope we can talk again.
Likewise. Thanks.
Up next, how nonprofits here are navigating the rocky economic waters brought on by the pandemic. And later, we'll take a look at what the newly voter-approved transit levy means for Hamilton County. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Local nonprofits are facing economic devastation due to the current pandemic. We continue the weekly news review now with WCPO reporter Dan Monk. He's on the phone. Dan, how are you? Hi, Dan, are you there?
I am. Are you there?
I sure am, and we are live on the air. I hope you're doing well out there in spite of all of this.
Yeah, so far so good. A lot of remote work, working from home, staffing the Delhi Bureau, as I like to call it. But so far, healthy, happy, sane. Everything like that.
Well,
how about you?
We're doing just fine. You know, we miss our colleagues just like you do. I saw your colleague Lucy May's tweet with the video screen of some of our friends at WCPO, and I know you all miss each other like we miss each other, and we miss you all coming into the studio too, but you're still doing good work. So let's talk a little bit about some of the stories you had this week, and one was a deep exploration into the impact that the pandemic is having economically on some of our local nonprofits. Some real fascinating reporting here. And I want to start with the Welcome House of Northern Kentucky, and you sort of explore how this is an organization that had to step up to help the homeless population during the pandemic, spending six-figure sum on hotels so that people experiencing homelessness could stay in more separated environments rather than being in crowded shelters. Let's start there. Tell us a little bit about what that organization is facing, Dan.
Well, they're facing kind of a triple whammy of increased demand for services, a decline in available volunteers because people are staying home, and then they're also losing money on their fundraisers. They have one of their big annual fundraisers is a spring fundraising event where people contribute in-kind services, and usually they raise about $50,000 from that, and that number went to zero. They also spent $111,000 so far on these hotels so that people experiencing homelessness don't have to risk catching the virus in shelters and then spreading it to the community. And they were compensated. They were reimbursed by the COVID-19 Regional Response Fund to the tune of $50,000, but that still left a $61,000 gap. See, and you can see this kind of repeating all the way, sprinkling all the way through their budget. I think they have another fundraiser coming up in August, and they're not sure if they're going to be able to hold that. And so this is the kind of dilemma, really, that every nonprofit is facing. They're losing money from events, fundraising events. Sometimes they're having increased demand for services, and they're also losing volunteers and the ability to raise money through service revenue.
Dan, you talked to Doug Bolton. He's the CEO of Cincinnati Cares. He's been on our program as well, talking about the issues that nonprofits are facing during the pandemic. But he said something to you that really struck me. Quote, most nonprofits have less than 1 month of reserves available to them. And so when something like this comes along, Dan, they've got very little wiggle room.
Yeah, I mean, nonprofits have always said that they run a lean operation, but I really wasn't aware that it was was that lean, and I think that's one reason why the nonprofit sector is being more greatly impacted than some of the sectors in the economy that we've seen so far. Certainly, hotels, restaurants, retail, those are all hard hit sectors. But I don't think anybody has this impact from the loss of volunteer help. You know, like in the last recession, 2008, people lost jobs, and certainly nonprofits lost donations. So same thing happened in 9/11, but this time around, the nonprofits don't have the benefit of volunteers to kind of help them stretch their dollar further. So this particular pandemic, this economic event, I think is more treacherous for nonprofits than certainly any other recession we've had.
And, of course, not all nonprofits are created equal. Some are very small and some are quite large and important cultural institutions like the Cincinnati Zoo. And you talked to Thane Maynard, our friend of the show here and the director of the Cincinnati Zoo, about some of the issues that the zoo might face. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, the biggest is the loss of revenue. He is expecting that the zoo will essentially be cut in half this year revenue-wise, and also from the standpoint of attendance. Last year they drew 1.8 million people, and he's thinking if they can open in June, which is certainly not assured, but if they can open sometime in June, he thinks they can get to 800,000 in terms of annual attendance. Even after they open, they'll have to do it with smaller crowds. So what they're trying to do is adopt a system where you would have a timed ticket. You would go online and buy a ticket and then show up at an appointed time. That way they can let, you know, maybe 250 people in every half hour, kind of spread the population across the 80 acres there at the zoo and keep everybody safely distanced from each other.
And we're talking with Dan Monk, a reporter at WCPO. And right now we're discussing the economic impact on local nonprofits. Dan, the arts community is being hit really hard, too. And look, every part of the economy, it seems, is being hit. But the arts community, you have to think about some of the shows that were set to open this spring and won't be opening, some of their fundraisers that were set to take place that may not happen or happen in a minimal capacity. You spoke with Andrew Hungerford from the No Theater and Over the Rhine. It's a smaller professional theater here in town. What's going on with them, for example?
Well, they're going to have a 25% revenue hit of about $200,000. They're going to use hundreds fewer volunteers this year and fewer part-time staff. So far, they have been able to keep their full-timers fully employed. And that's likely to continue because they were approved for a paycheck protection loan. I think it was in the $30,000 range. It was a small loan, but it certainly was enough for them to keep their full-timers engaged. And they're just kind of, you know, changing a lot of what they do, a lot of online presentation, virtual presentation. When they resume, and if they resume sometime this year, their productions will have smaller cast sizes, smaller crowds will come to see the shows. And Andrew was particularly disappointed with a show that they were planning to do that was tied to the new Wonder Woman movie, and it was a play that was based on you know, that Wonder Woman story. And that thing was supposed to debut, I think, in early June, at the same time the movie was going to come out. So that they were counting on that as a big revenue producer for them, and it obviously is not going to happen.
Yeah, not to mention their Fringe Festival that has grown significantly over these past 20 years. That looks like it will be happening.
Yeah, although interestingly, they did raise some revenue in their Fringe Festival by taking a lot of that online. It certainly wasn't as big an event as it has been for them in the past, but it's kind of an example of how nonprofits are not just standing pat here and trying to hunker down. They're actually trying to alter their approach. And, you know, people who have fundraising events are trying to do it as much online as possible. The Urban League is offering a new service where it has a text line that people can call 24/7 or a text 24/7 for advice. And they're getting a lot of people, you know, texting for questions and information that they're looking for. So there is a lot of innovation happening in this sector, and that's probably a good sign that, you know, nonprofits are not going to go down without a fight.
And there are, in the world of nonprofits, nonprofits that help the nonprofits, and some of those larger ones are the Greater Cincinnati Foundation, the United Way of Greater Cincinnati. First, how are they helping? And two, are they challenged as well?
Well, I think ArtsWave certainly is. I mean, they're raising money for nonprofits, but they're also a nonprofit and trying to make ends meet themselves. Greater Cincinnati Foundation and United Way were the kind of co-creators of this COVID-19 relief fund, which so far has raised $7.2 million from local foundations and corporations, and they've distributed already $6.5 million. That is roughly on par with how Pittsburgh has done. They also have an emergency fund, as does Cleveland. Indianapolis is probably the biggest in the region because they have access to the Eli Lilly Foundation, and I think they've distributed $11 million so far. But last I checked, Greater Cincinnati Foundation and United Way were still trying to raise money, and they're doing a pretty good job of getting the money out there quickly and to as many nonprofits as possible. One distinction, I think we compared 8 different emergency funds in different cities within a 300-mile radius of Cincinnati. And Cincinnati's fund distributed grants to more organizations. We had the highest number of grant recipients. I think it was like 236 nonprofits actually received money from that COVID-19 rapid response fund.
Will coronavirus be an extinction event for local nonprofits? That's the headline for this story from Dan Monk, as well as Lucy May and Craig Cheatham. You can read that at WCPO.com. Before I let you go, Dan, I'm hoping you can update us on the situation involving Delta and CVG. I can't believe we're still talking about Delta shrinking at our airport. Yeah. What's the latest?
Well, they've cited COVID-19 as the reason, but they've eliminated the crew base in Cincinnati. There are 150 pilots who currently are based in Cincinnati, meaning that most of them live near the airport and they fly out of that airport primarily. And they're going to do away with that because their flight schedule has been declining over time since the days when it was one of the regional hubs for Delta. And I think they're in the cost-cutting mode right now because of COVID-19, and so they're taking this as an opportunity, essentially, to eliminate that crew base. Now, I think that what that means for pilots is they will be based at another hub, like Atlanta, perhaps, or Detroit, but they don't necessarily have to move there, the way it was explained to me, that these pilots can continue to live in Cincinnati and then commute from Cincinnati to their, flight that they're going to be working that day. I did ask some pilots, but couldn't get a clear answer on how many people are likely to leave Cincinnati, how many of these pilots are likely to leave Cincinnati. In a lot of cases, when hubs are transferred, the pilots move with the hub, or at least the majority of them do. So chances are we're going to lose some pilots locally. They're going to have to relocate to another city in order to, have greater access to the hub where they're home-based.
Well, we do appreciate that update. Dan Monk, the singular Monk. I'm the plural Monks. WCPO reporter Dan Monk, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for taking the time with us today.
Thank you.
Up next, what are we learning about the way we use streets during this pandemic? Will we make improvements on this, on the other side of the pandemic? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Hamilton County voters approved a significant transit levy. The weekly news review continues now with WCPO reporter and one of my favorite Covington neighbors, Pat LaFleur. He's here to talk about it on the phone. Pat, welcome.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Our pleasure to have you on. Looking forward to having you back in the studio someday soon. So let's talk about Issue 7. This thing passed. It's called historic in the headline to your story, but it passed by less than 1%. Talk about why it's historic.
The history that was made with this passage is that for the last 50 years or so, Cincinnati Metro has only been funded primarily through a city tax, the city's earnings tax. So what made history yesterday was that now Cincinnati Metro, for the first time, has a county-based funding source, and that, of course, will be the 0.8% of the sales tax for Hamilton County. And I believe they start that tax increase will go into effect on October 1st of this year.
Okay, so 0.7% was the victory margin for this. And in raw numbers, it looks like 67,698 voted in favor against 66,718 voted no. I mean, this was close. Can we talk a little bit about the people involved on both sides of this in terms of the campaigns that they waged and how they felt afterwards?
Sure. So there was a huge effort put behind getting this passed. The political action committee was called Move Forward Hamilton County. That consisted of leaders from the Democratic Party, from some from the Republican Party, others from the Charter Committee. So this did have a wide range of support. The opposition was less organized, I would describe it as. Hamilton County has a long history of being pretty staunchly opposed to any sort of tax increases. So there's always that context within which any campaign like this is going to be interacting. But the key players as far as who was supporting this issue were the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber of Commerce was a big engine pushing for this. There was a grassroots transit advocacy organization, that's the Better Bus Coalition. They've been making headlines for a few years now, even before Issue 7 was put on the ballot. They've been working to try to boost up Cincinnati Metro service, which over the last decade or so has been slowly declining, both in terms of its financials as well as in terms of its ridership. So the Better Bus Coalition and the Cincinnati Chamber were the two big players as far as pushing for this over the last 6 months or so.
And so with narrow passage, the measure raises the county sales tax by 0.8%, so that makes it 7.8%. This creates a new funding source for the Metro Bus Service and some of the road and bridges improvements. So what does that mean exactly? What would people start to see because of this new funding mechanism?
Sure. So as far as bus service is concerned, and in theory, you know, the Transit Authority won't start seeing any of this new tax revenue until January 2021, right? There's a three-month delay between when a tax levy is initiated and when the first dollars start arriving on the scene, as it were. So the hope is, or Metro's hope is anyway, that this increase in funding will mean more bus service to more parts of the region, and specifically Hamilton County. So the idea is we'll start seeing more routes run longer hours, more routes run more frequently, so more buses on the roads. We'll see some new routes is part of the plan here. Some would be crosstown routes that, you know, connect the east and west halves of the county directly. Right now, Metro's network of bus routes is what's described as a hub and spoke system, where, you know, you might be living in Westwood and you need to get to, say, Mount Airy, or Mount Airy is a bad example, excuse me. How about somewhere on the east side? You'd have to come through downtown and then go back out rather than going directly across the county. So it's improvements like this that the supporters of Issue 7 say will be funded by this new funding source.
And we're talking with WCPO reporter Pat LaFleur about that transit levy that just passed. We appreciate you breaking that part down. Let's talk about another one of your stories. And before we dive into some of the information that you gathered and the people that you talked to, my goodness, are you noticing, like me, people trying so hard to get away from you while you're just walking on the sidewalk, and maybe you're doing the same, and so it's kind of awkward?
Yeah, that's at least the few times a week I do venture out, at least walking through my neighborhood. There's definitely the impulse personally to walk into the street for a few seconds in order to space myself properly. But, you know, I'd say it's about 50-50 folks I encounter. Some seem to think about it. Then the other half maybe don't seem to really care, or it's just not on their minds. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it seems like that's going to be more interesting, because really, you start your article that we're going to discuss here with talking about how sidewalks feel even narrower doing this. And we're hearing about a lot of communities. I know several Northern Kentucky cities this week have announced, you know, that they're suspending their zoning rules about outdoor dining so they can give as much space as possible to tables and chairs for people to eat outside, since there's reduced capacity indoors. But the sidewalks still have to be ADA compliant and still have to have room. I mean, should we be watching for sidewalks possibly to shrink even more during this?
Well, that's kind of the question that's still, I think, up in the air as these plans unfold. The city of Cincinnati is another example where today we're seeing several bars and restaurants in Over the Rhine opening up and expanding their patios. Now the question of whether that will still allow for proper social distancing for people walking through those neighborhoods, I haven't gotten a straight answer to. And from everyone I've spoken with in that neighborhood, they're still unclear about that question as well. So I think there's still some details to be ironed out, even though, you know, today is the day that it starts, at least in Ohio. And I think we're still waiting for clarification on that question.
And so your article starts to explore what we're learning about public space as we all adjust to life in this pandemic, particularly around streets and sidewalks. Talk about what you found, some of the trends that are possibly influencing the way people think here.
Well, so I spoke with one Northside resident who, you know, the reason that he moved to that neighborhood was because he enjoyed the dense, narrower streets, narrower sidewalks. That's what he enjoyed, and now he's finding in this situation that actually creates a health risk in the current environment. So, you know, one question he had was, could we possibly repurpose some of these parking lanes as just expanded sidewalks? You know, we've heard a lot about repurposing parking space as outdoor dining space, but really there were already folks in this region, particularly in the running and cycling communities, people who get out and use these spaces quite frequently. There was already a call for repurposing some of this underused street space as simply a place for people to be able to walk with a distance between themselves and another person who might also be walking in that same area. So beyond just food and dining, the question had already begun to surface: can we rethink the way that we are using this street space that, quite frankly, over the last 8 weeks or so, has been underutilized because of the respective stay-at-home orders in each state? You have fewer people out driving. The number of vehicle miles traveled in Hamilton County plummeted once the stay-at-home order went into effect. Something like 70-80% of the vehicle miles traveled in the region dropped. So we have these public rights of way that were designed for vehicles, primarily for vehicles, and now the vehicles aren't there. So it's created what some think is an opportunity to try to get creative. And one example that I came across was from a local organization called Tri-State Trail.
And this is an example I wanted to talk about, Pat, here in our last minute together.
Yeah.
It involves the Veterans Memorial 4th Street Bridge that connects Newport and Covington across the Licking River. And it, if anyone listening has ever walked across it on the sidewalks spans, which are on both sides, boy, they're very, very narrow. So what does Tri-State Trails hope to do here?
Yeah, so they had the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet had to close one of that bridge's three road lanes due to weight concerns. I'm told the cabinet is working on an emergency plan to repair that so they can reopen that lane. But what Tri-State Trails would like to see happen is that lane be permanently reassigned as a walking and biking trail. And the Transportation Cabinet tells me that they're still working out their plan, but they're keeping an open mind about how to make that bridge safer for people walking and biking, because as you mentioned, those walkways are 4 feet wide, and that's not an exaggeration. They're four feet wide only. A person in a motorized wheelchair might come across another person in a wheelchair, and one of them is going to have to back up off the bridge to allow the other to pass, and that's just not a sustainable design.
Pat LaFleur is a reporter at WCPO. Thanks for coming on, Pat. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon, maybe in person someday soon.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks, Michael. Stay well.
You too. And the weekly news review continues now with one of our homegrown reporters here from WVXU. Joining us on the phone is Tana Weingartner. Tana, how are you? Do we have Tana on the line? I think I hear her there. Tana, are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay, I think that somehow I got on the wrong line, maybe.
That's okay.
Anyway, glad to be here.
I'm glad that you're here, too. We're all kind of learning this new socially distanced connecting and switching between people. It's no big deal. Our listeners understand. Anyway, let's check in with you because it's a big weekend for parts of the economy. Tell us what we need to know about dining establishments and bars. What do we need to know about this weekend?
Well, today's the day. You can eat outside or go to a bar outside if the business is open. So lots of changes, though, obviously. You have to have physical distancing. For example, if you're at a restaurant outside, it has to be 6 feet from the back of every chair to the next chair. All the cleaning procedures, of course. There's some rules about wearing masks and who has to wear them and whatnot. There's a lot that kind of goes into it.
Yeah, it appears to be quite a complicated process. And I noticed that you spoke to Councilman David Mann here in Cincinnati, and he expressed a concern that this type of resumed activity may lead to a mindset that everything is safe now.
Yeah, that was his concern yesterday during an update to a joint meeting of a couple of different city council committees that were getting updated on how the city's rolling out this very kind of hastily put together plan for allowing restaurants and bars to expand outside. And yeah, that was his primary concern, was that now that these things are reopening, everyone's been cooped up, they're just going to rush out and think that everything is okay since the business is open. But he made the point, it's not, that COVID-19 is still around and still very problematic.
And it's costly in some respects to businesses for this reopening, is it not, as it relates to road lane barricades and maybe additional police details?
Yeah, so the businesses that choose to reopen, not only do they have their costs that they have to, take care of, they're getting supplies and their employees and everything, but they also have to cover the cost of everything that's being required of this new layout. So, for example, you can write up a plan to say, I'm going to use part of this road that goes right by my thing. So that means that you have to have some sort of barricade. What I'm thinking of most typically you see are those giant orange, almost Lego piece-looking things. They fill them with water. So you might have to have, and one of those costs $500 to $600, but you might need like seven of those to cordon off an area. The businesses themselves have to pay for that. Also, if you need a police detail because of what you're doing, maybe to direct traffic or things like that, businesses are being asked to shoulder all of those costs as well.
Well, another part of the economy that we're seeing reopen is the healthcare side of things. You visited virtually or spoke with a local dentist. Talk about some of the procedures they went through.
That was a little serendipitous. I go to my dentist like a good little person every 6 months. You know, that's what our interns here at Cincinnati Public Radio covers. And so 6 months ago, I had made an appointment for Wednesday, and my dentist office happened to open this week. So they called up last week and said, we're opening. Would you like to keep your appointment? And I said, you know, and they explained they have procedures. So, yeah, I went to the dentist and I took my microphone. So it's a fairly small practice, I guess, that I go to. But some of the things they're doing is when I got there, I had to call and say, you know, I'm in the parking lot. And they said, okay, you can come in now. I had been previously screened. They asked me a bunch of questions about my health. And then when I got there, I was asked all of those questions again. They took my temperature. When I came in, I went straight in with the hygienist. Everybody in the dentist office was wearing masks. We went straight into the little room. Now, the crazy thing is, I mean, not crazy, but the health-related thing is the hygienist and the dentist, they're wearing three masks, which I just can't imagine how hard that must be and how hot it must be. So they're wearing an N95, and then on top of that, a surgical mask, and then on top of that, a plastic face shield. Now, not every dentist office is like that, but that's what mine is doing. And they keep that N95 on all day, the hygienist said, except for when they have lunch.
Well, I mean, we must be on the same dental schedule because 6 months ago I set one up and it's scheduled for next Friday. And you remind me, I need to check to see if that's still on. I've been going to the same dentist since I was 12, and I guess it's going to look a lot different this time. The wallpaper will still be the same, I imagine, from the early 90s, but we'll see what happens here. Very quickly, we got a minute left, and I know you did this cool story about summer camps because summer looks so strange right now and so uncertain. What can we expect for some of the area summer camps?
Well, I think they're all going to have to start figuring it out. They just got handed their regulations yesterday. So, you know, they've been sort of on the fence. What are we going to be able to do? A lot have already canceled their programs in June, and we're looking for July. You know, they're going to have to keep groups small and, you know, think about how they're socially distancing, you know, kids at a camp, which is difficult. And I know at least for some camps that provide transportation, that's a big hurdle that they're going to try and have to figure out if it's even an option. Because, you know, it's hard to space kids out on a bus and get them all to the camp.
Tana Weingartner from WVXU. We look forward to seeing that freshly clean smile of yours in person very soon. So thank you for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition here on 91.7 WVXU, where the producer is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Today's technical director is Rick Andress. And you can find archives of our program, every episode, online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.